It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For months, abortion was seen as a key issue in the 2024 November election.
Vice President Kamala Harris repeatedly held campaign stops and ran advertising on her stance on reproductive rights, telling Wisconsin Today in September that she would abolish the Senate filibuster to pass legislation codifying abortion access into law.
But former President Trump took Wisconsin and other swing states Tuesday, raising questions about voter sentiment and the importance of abortion policy as an issue for voters.
Alyssa Von Hagel is a professor in the Social Inquiry Department at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Her research focuses on reproductive rights and abortion policy. Alyssa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alyssa, I want to start with something we don't really have in Wisconsin, these citizen-backed referenda we saw in states around the country. 10 states had measures to expand abortion access on the ballot. 7 passed, including some conservative states, Missouri and Montana. Florida, it fell short of a 60% threshold, but still majority support there. Nebraska had 2. They actually voted to codify restrictions on abortion. Okay. Put that all on the hopper. What do you make of what you saw around the country in those referenda?
I mean, I think overall we do see success for these reproductive rights measures. As you noted, there were a few, that didn't pass. The one in Florida received over 57% of the vote. So clearly, again, just 3% short of that threshold. But clearly, even in a state that is known for being conservative on the issue, we see that a majority of the citizens wanted those protections. The other failure in South Dakota is one of the states that has no protections for reproductive rights in the states and has been conservative on the issue for really for most of the state's history. And so I think, but overall, regardless of those few exceptions, we see that voters are working to expand or maintain access to reproductive care.
I'm not the first to point out that in some of these states, Florida and Missouri, clearly there are some people who voted in favor of abortion access, of reproductive rights, but vote for politicians who, for the most part, oppose expanding those restrictions. What does that tell us about voters? One thing that leaps to mind is, hey, maybe we don't see those single issue voters on abortion that people might have expected.
Correct. And also, when voting for candidates, people obviously evaluate candidates in their totality. And so there could have been other issues that were of greater concern, had greater salience for voters than abortion. Certainly since the ruling in Dobbs has been, a few years out, it may not have the immediate importance in voters' minds that it did perhaps immediately following the ruling, or again, other issues such as the economy or immigration just simply was a priority for voters that abortion politics just simply couldn't match.
Bringing things to Wisconsin now, we don't have that kind of ballot measure on abortion access here, but many Democratic candidates, including U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin with a narrow win, Kamala Harris with a narrow loss in the state, congressional candidates and others really did focus on that abortion issue. As you sift through results, how do you think abortion policy affected Wisconsin this election cycle?
It is hard to say, of course, with the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreeing to take up a challenge to the law that essentially invalidated access to reproductive care in the state. It may not have been as of great importance or concern for voters because of anticipation of the court ruling on this particular measure. Also, again, I think, as we saw nationwide, that there are other issues that drove people to vote for a particular candidate or to not vote for a particular candidate. And reproductive rights may not have been the, most salient or important issue that drove voters to the polls.
Alyssa Von Hagel is with us from UW-Superior, looking at reproductive rights and abortion issues in this week's election. Vice President Harris conceded officially yesterday afternoon in a speech, but she called on supporters to organize for more reproductive rights in the future. Here's a listen.
Where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government government telling them what to do.
The election is over. This issue continues to remain a big one. Alyssa, what are you watching for next when it comes to laws and rules on abortion access in the United States?
Well, I think there's a number of important things to watch. First of all, in upcoming election cycles, it will be interesting to see if other states initiate initiatives, proposals, amendments, or changes to the state constitution to either expand, maintain, or even retract reproductive rights. The trend seems at this point towards states wanting to, at the very least, maintain, if not expand, access to reproductive rights. But that will be important to watch in the coming years. Also of importance is what happens in Congress. There's been some discussion of federal laws that are bills that would either legislate protections for or restrictions on access to abortion nationwide. So it'll be interesting to see what comes forward on this issue in the upcoming session of Congress.
And Alyssa, I want to focus on that federal issue for a bit, because I think since Roe v. Wade was overturned, a lot of people thought, OK, this is a state's issue now. There have been calls from some people, conservative groups organizing the agenda for a new Trump presidency, saying, hey, let's take this 1800s law, the Comstock Act, and use it to restrict the distribution of abortion medications. Then Senator, now Vice President J.D. Vance, signed a letter in 2023 saying, yes, the Department of Justice should crack down on this. The FDA should make that clear. Are you watching for potentially executive action from the White House under this argument that they don't even need empowering legislation from Congress?
It is definitely something to watch for. And if they were to pursue that approach, I think they would very quickly find that it would be immensely unpopular, not just with the electorate as a whole, but even amongst Republican or conservative voters. Also, again, whether or not they would be able to effectively implement such a measure, the threat or even discussion of such a measure may spur members of Congress to introduce restrictions on, say, medication abortion or other forms of reproductive care that aren't quite as stringent but still restrict access.
Then zooming back in on Wisconsin, you've mentioned the current state of the court back and forth over this 1800s law in Wisconsin. The current status from one judge is that law is not in effect. So those very severe limits on abortion, they're not in place. Going to end up at our state Supreme Court. Hold on. It has a liberal majority today. There is an election coming up that could conceivably flip that majority. The state of affairs and abortion law in Wisconsin are in flux. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. I think that that is the perfect way of characterizing the issue today in Wisconsin.
And do you see this being an issue? Well, let's stay with that state Supreme Court race. I assume this is going to be a big issue in that court race coming up early next year.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw in the previous Supreme Court race that for really one of the first times in Wisconsin and even across the nation, we see that the issue of abortion playing a central role in an election, which, again, is up until this point had really been exceptionally rare. So I fully anticipate that it would absolutely remain the case in the upcoming election as well.
And then I know people probably have election fatigue. They don't want to talk about 2 years from now. But 2 years from now, Attorney General, Governor of Wisconsin, and of course, the state legislature up for grabs. In addition to the influence the Supreme Court could have with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, a legislature, a governor, if they ended up in same party control, could really set the agenda for abortion laws in the state. Do you expect to see that being front and center in those races?
There's no reason to think otherwise. You know, as long as the issue remains in flux, as you mentioned, it remains the case that people will be spurred to action, to vote, to campaign on the issue. And so I think that it's certainly, you know, outside of a, you know, definitive court ruling or, you know, action by the legislature that very clearly addresses the issue, it will remain a political issue for, you know, the future in Wisconsin.
We've talked about the Democratic strategy of hitting the abortion issue. On the Republican side, it's been interesting. In his first race for president, president-elect Trump had said, hey, he would appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. He did that. In this race, at a couple points, he said he's a friend of reproductive rights, seemed to be backing away from that issue. What are you watching for from Republicans?
We saw that approach amongst many Republicans, in that it's clear that voters, even in more conservative or red-leaning states, are supportive of, you know, access to reproductive care. And so Republicans have been walking back their previous stances, either focusing on late-term abortions or on arguing for states' rights on the issue. So clearly they're aware that there is widespread support for some measure of protecting access to reproductive care.
Very briefly, Elisa, gender gap in Republican versus Democratic voters. Briefly, what are you watching as you sift through the numbers?
It'll be interesting to see how age plays a role in that gender gap. We know going into the race that there is not quite a strong gender gap in voting with respect to young men, whereas it's quite large when we look at younger women. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out with voters of different age categories.
Elisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
That's Elisa von Hagel, professor in the Social Inquiry Department at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Her research focuses on reproductive rights and abortion policy.
Coming up, Wisconsin political scientist Kathy Kramer has been talking to voters in the state and around the country for years now to find out what motivates their decisions. She joins us for a look at the issues that drove the outcomes in this week's election. That's coming up next here in Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With former President Donald Trump winning a second term in office, now comes the analysis on what motivated voters to reelect him.
A researcher here in Wisconsin has been following this story pretty much her entire career.
Catherine Kramer has been talking to voters around Wisconsin and beyond for years. Her 2016 book, The Politics of Resentment, garnered national attention for the way it captured the urban-rural divide.
She's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. We check in with her now to see what she's been observing about voter attitudes and how they shape the election results. Kathy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you again.
Now, a big part of your research has always been doing listening sessions with people, not just surveys, which could be fine, but actually talking to community members, voters in different communities. Lately, what kind of talk running up to the election in particular were you hearing when it came to economic issues?
For a lot of people, there's a sense of insecurity about their economic life right now that isn't necessarily new, but has been around for some time, and just a widespread perception that the economy was not built for people like them. The economy is kind of rigged against them. And we've heard that from people of a variety of political leanings.
Well, our reporters at WPR were at polling locations around the state on Election Day, and they found both Trump voters and Harris voters talking about economic issues and inflation. I want to give a listen to a couple of them. A voter named Angel Merzberger in Brookfield said her top two issues were the economy and abortion. She said she would be voting for Harris. Here's a listen.
The price of groceries, the price of living is just... We live paycheck to paycheck right now, and we used to not do that. So that's why I'm here today, because there needs to be change.
And we heard from Mike Flannery in Waukesha, who said he's going to vote for Trump. His top issues were the economy and the border. Here's a listen to Mike.
I think just for me, the economy, I work in real estate. And so seeing the affordability, interest rates are being obviously elevated. The economy itself with inflation, the cost of groceries, things like that. The last 4 years have been pretty terrible versus the prior four.
I want to key on that issue of inflation that both a Harris voter and a Trump voter mentioned there. We had this global inflation epidemic basically for a couple years there. Jobs numbers can look good, but hey, if you have a job, you have 100% employment. If you don't, you have 0%. Inflation numbers people see every time they buy something. How much do you think that this factored into this election?
Yeah, it matters a lot because you're exactly right. It's when people don't necessarily see the kind of the aggregate indicators of how well the economy is doing, but what they see are food prices and gas prices, and it's just a much more kind of everyday reminder of in their world how the economy is doing. So, yeah, the inflation mattered a lot for voters. And it's so interesting, these two conversations you had with Angel and Mike. I mean, they're as you say, they're going to support, they planned on supporting different candidates. And people may feel that the economy is difficult for them. A variety of people may feel that, but their interpretation of who or what is to blame is really different, right? And the party that they lean toward is where they get their cues on who's to blame. And you can see in their comments that they have very different ideas about whose fault it is that they're feeling these economic challenges.
I want to run a hypothesis about this election by you, Kathy. I don't know if I believe it, just something I've been thinking about. A very small swing in Wisconsin, of course, can sway an election. We have under 1% wins in three consecutive presidential elections. As much as we talk about the uniqueness of Donald Trump as a polarizing figure, like him or not, this was a very normal election. Here's my hypothesis. People are watching this inflation. They're unhappy about that. Enough of them. They look, they say which party is in the White House, and they say maybe a change will help fix this problem that I'm seeing every day. What do you think of that notion?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think we political scientists have known for a long time that presidential elections can be understood as kind of a referendum on the incumbent party. And so even though Joe Biden wasn't on the ballot, his party was. And the low unpopularity of Joe Biden and the challenges that people have been having with the economy drive a lot of the outcome, and it clearly drove a lot of the outcome. So I think you're exactly right.
I want to revisit the economy in a few minutes, but I want to pick up a theme you've talked about a lot over the years. I've talked to you about it and your book, The Politics of Resentment, The Urban-Rural Divide. The perception in rural Wisconsin was the focus of your work at that point of, the urban America was getting something that they weren't in effect. How do you see that playing out in 2024?
It's still a part of our story here in Wisconsin and in the country, but what I understand now in more recent research I've been doing is that it's part of a more general divide, political divide that's taken place in this country. And it's partly, it can be understood a lot in the college gap that we see in electoral returns in this election and other recent elections, where college-educated people especially white college-educated people are leaning toward the Democratic Party, and people without a four-year college degree are increasingly leaning toward the Republican Party. And there's something to be said about the perspective that one that a person develops living in a rural place versus an urban place, but also the greater likelihood that you, if you have a four-year college degree, that you live in a more urban community is part of what's going on in terms of this geographic polarization too, where we see urban areas going, you know, predominantly Democratic and more smaller communities or rural places going Republican.
And that's been changing over time. Republicans used to do okay with college grads, just fine among college graduates. Democrats used to have some rural strongholds. Southwestern Wisconsin, I think one of the most dramatic shifts in the country, some counties, Crawford County, I think, and others. What is it that the people there are changing? Is that what the parties are saying and doing is changing? What is driving that change?
Yeah, a little bit of both. And I would say largely what the parties are doing and saying and the arguments that they're giving to people. But I say a little bit of both because in Wisconsin and across the country, that the conditions of rural communities and urban communities have diverged over time, especially since the 1970s. And by that, I mean, generally, it's urban communities where we see economic growth, and rural communities have either stagnated in their local economies or experienced a decline. And we also see that in population numbers, too, in Wisconsin and around the country, where, you know, it's urban communities where we see population growth. But again, rural communities, they're experiencing, you know, a so-called brain drain or a lack of opportunities for young people to come back and get a job in the rural community in which they grew up. So rural communities experiencing population stagnation or decline. And another thing that's happened too is this college divide where, you know, back in 1970, it was roughly 10% of people either in a rural community, a rural county specifically, or an urban county had a four-year college degree. But that's changed drastically. It's, you know, in the last 40, 50 years where people in urban communities are just much more likely. About one in three people in an urban county have a college degree these days, but only one in five in people in rural counties. And also, finally, like the other condition that's really changed, or the way these rural and urban communities have diverged over time, is in the racial and ethnic composition. Here in Wisconsin and around the country, you know, the urban communities have become much more racially diverse. And that's true of rural communities too, but not at the same rate. So what's going on for people has changed, but also, as you say, the other part of this, it's not just that people have changed, it's the nature of our politics have changed and the kind of arguments that the politicians are making to people have changed. And the Republican Party has done very well for itself by tapping into, you know, what I understand to be this rural resentment or this sense of, you know, we're not getting our fair share. And it's folks in the cities who are getting the resources and the attention and the respect.
This might be out of left field, Kathy, but a theme of many interviews I've done over the years is rural communities have less access to blank, medical professionals, lawyers, mental health counseling, drug treatment, things like that. Professional services often provided by college graduates. The economics of those businesses make it harder to make a living and pay off student loans in those rural communities. They're college graduates, and maybe they want to live in those urban communities. Is that contributing to feeling abandoned, to feeling like, hey, we're not getting some of these basic needs met?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at hospital closures, just that one indicator in our state, right? Like hospitals around the state are having a tough time, and it's not just rural communities that have seen hospitals close, but arguably they've been harder hit by the kind of the crisis facing our healthcare system, especially post-pandemic. And yeah, it's tough to, you know, it's difficult to live in a community where, for example, you're at something of a risk by being pregnant. Like how far you have to drive when it's finally time to deliver your baby. It's a concern to people, and they look to urban areas and don't see that same kind of concern. And so it does, for a lot of people, it feels like, wait a minute, what about us?
Talking to Kathy Kramer from UW-Madison, author of the book, The Politics of Resentment, looking at voter attitudes toward the economy, rural-urban divides, and more. Kathy, you are in the midst of a big project. You're working with this commission on reimagining the economy. And you mentioned a lot of people in both parties feeling like, hey, I'm living in an economic landscape designed for someone other than me. How do you even start to reimagine something that huge?
Yeah, I think by starting exactly what you're talking about, what you're focusing on, is just how people are experiencing the economy and their perceptions of it. And I say that because a lot of times when we think about the health of the economy, we're talking about like GDP and, you know, kind of aggregate indicators. And we're not necessarily talking about how are people experiencing the economy and what do we need to do to create an economy that contributes to the well-being of the American people, not necessarily focus on the well-being of the economy as a whole. Sometimes those things are the same, but not necessarily. And people, as I was, you know, in as response to one of your first questions, people have this sense that the economy is not built for their well-being. The economy is built to make money, generate profits. And, they are not necessarily the beneficiaries of that.
There was traditionally a sense that, okay, Republicans are the party that leans toward business, Democrats for labor. I think a change in the Clinton era, our perception that with trade agreements and things like that, Democrats also turning into a party that served business. Did that contribute to a feeling that, you know, there isn't a political outlet for those economic concerns that people feel?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, and that change that you're talking about, and the shift, I mean, a lot of times the way we think about it within political science is the partisan leanings of people who are in kind of white folks in working class occupations, and the way their partisan leanings have shifted over time is really pretty significant. So, you know, back in the Clinton era, even in a bit before that, they tended to align with the Democratic Party, but that has shifted a lot in recent decades, and they're tending increasingly to align with the Republican Party. And it's part of the massive changes we've experienced in this country, in our economy, we're feeling it in our politics these days. That is for sure.
And we could talk for hours about the economy and our politics and well-being. I want to shift gears for our last few minutes, though, Kathy, and look at gender. A gender gap we see in support of more men voting for Republicans and Donald Trump, more women voting for Democrats and Kamala Harris. A woman running as the Democratic candidate for the second time. I've heard some people point out, okay, Trump loses to the guy and wins over two women. Is there a part of the populace, the electorate, that's going to swing their vote based on there being a female candidate?
Probably. We need a few more weeks or so to sort out exactly how that worked in this election. But according to the election the exit polls, the gender gap in this election was not that all that different from recent elections, which may be a little bit surprising, knowing that the issue of abortion is top of mind for many people in the electorate. But what I think it speaks to is the way, and in your previous segment, how you were talking about with your guest about how the Donald Trump really distanced himself from the issue of abortion during his campaign. And so it's possible that abortion wasn't as strong of an issue in this election as we might have expected a few months ago. So yes, my sense is that having a woman of color at the top of the Democratic ticket would matter for the gender gap. But so far, it looks like it didn't have a huge effect on the outcome of this election.
And I'm wondering if this is something that's come up to you in your conversations with people around the state and around the country, Kathy. a concern about change, right? I grew up in this community. This might especially be a rural community. It could also be a city neighborhood. This is not the neighborhood I grew up in. And maybe that's racial or ethnic composition. Maybe that's the factory closed or the farm economy isn't what it used to be, or the community doesn't feel as cohesive. Can be a lot of things. How much does that concern that this isn't the community I thought I was growing up in one way or another affect how people think about politics, maybe vote in elections?
I think it matters a lot, but what how it matters varies a lot by people's partisan leanings. So, if you're that sense of, as you say, like it could be this sense of, you know, racial change or a sense that the demographic composition of my community, my place, my state is changing, and I'm not comfortable with that. In other words, a sense of racism, right? Like it could be that. It could also be this sense of how life in the U.S. seems really different right now with respect to the economy, for example. Like it's just harder to make ends meet. And so that there's also that uncertainty, right? And then there's also just huge uncertainty about our political life these days. And all this talk about this election being a referendum on the future of democracy gives people a sense of something is really shifting, and I'm not sure where it's going. But again, like what people do with that really matters with which party they lean toward, and really the leaders that they're listening to, or even the online influencers they're listening to.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
You too, Rob. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
That's Catherine Kramer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. Been talking about voter attitudes, what they can tell us about this week's election results 8 years after she put out her book, The Politics of Resentment.
Still ahead, a poet from DePere has a new collection with odes to different parts of the body.
Poetry comes from the body, comes from mysterious sources, and you find yourself creating metaphors that try to capture what you don't know.
The collection is called Time Remaining. That's coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now we take a break from the news to make space for some poetry.
James Lenfesty was born and raised in DePere and has written 7 collections of poetry over his 7 decades of life.
In Lenfesty's new collection, he explores the aging body in a section called Body Odes.
He asks his left hand, how did you get so strange?
His belly, why is it you thicken with age like curd?
He celebrates his heart, which the cardiologist tells him looks good.
And he praises the powers of the hyoid bone, the only bone in the body not connected to any other.
James Lenfesty is a poet and journalist. His forthcoming collection is called Time Remaining, Body Odes, Praise Songs, Oddities, Amazements. James, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
A delight to be with you. I'm a Wisconsin boy, born and raised.
Oh, we're going to get into that.
Okay, cool.
But we're going to first have you read a poem to bring us together. It's the first poem in your book, The Invocation, and it's called Where Poets Go. Can you read that for us?
I will. I'll give you a little background. It's dedicated to a gentleman named Richard or Dick Moore, who, since you're on public radio, will know he was the founder of California Public Radio and then the first station manager for public TV in San Francisco. And then he came to the Twin Cities. And I got to know him and found out that his whole life he viewed himself as a poet. He went way back to the California Renaissance of Poetry with various famous people back then. And so he retired back to California. And when he passed away at the age of 95, I visited him many times in California in his incredible, what I call his monk cell in assisted living in his 90s. And he was still climbing mountains in his 80s. And so I wrote this elegy for him, and it went much farther than I had in mind, of course, when I started. Because it's called Where Poets Go for Dick Moore, 1920 to 2015. And two other notes. I was and still am a journalist of sorts, although I've written now 16 books of poems and anthologies, which is my great love, but it's all a love of language. But I'm a fact-based poet. Everything that's in here is all true. So the first two lines are, Where Poets Go, the Protestant cemetery in Rome, tomb of Keats' bubbled blood, and Shelley's beach-scorched bones. And I'm going to give you a little note about that. Keats died of tuberculosis in Italy and is buried there. And Shelley died in a sailing accident offshore, and his friends burned his bones on the beach. So now I'll start over with those first two lines, and we'll go from there. Where Poets Go. The Protestant cemetery in Rome, tomb of Keats' bubbled blood and Shelley's beach-scorched bones. The couch in Oregon, housing Stafford's quiet pad, his quiet pen. The cobbles of worn Nazareth, where Taha Muhammad Ali crafted peace in poems inside his tiny trinket shop. And Dick Moore's monk cell and assisted living in Marin, where he knew the spine of every book and made an eye-blind whiteboard sing exquisite blindness sonnets. And these are three of his lines. It is not a fair exchange, light for dark. So much remains on the other side of light. A world lost is never a fair exchange. I remember digging a hole for our dog, deep as I could among tangled cedar roots, and my daughter could not put him in. My wife could not put him in. What poems he wrote with his generous tongue. Poets earn no better place on earth than dogs or soldiers shot and rotting in a trench. All get our one slim slice of soil or air, organs plucked by condors like cello strings. Hymned by fungus, dug by moles, a modest cloud of ragged smoke. But listen. A poem by Sappho was just discovered in an ancient dump in broken Egypt. Unfurled now from papyrus junk, the whole world trembled as burnished sheaves flowered into Greek, twice sung already in English, as the Islamic State blasts and burns the stone remains of Nineveh. So many fragments in the rubble. Songs sung at dawn before the battle lost. A mother before an infant's bed. A man incanting a lover's chin. A child chanting charms against the dark. And Dick Moore's suite of sonnets arriving 10 days past his death in a book bright as Milton's Angel, a brilliant stop to time. Tuberculosis stilled the lungs of Keats and Stephen Crane, my hero. Seawater filled up Shelley with cobalt blue. Emily claimed the apt name Bright's disease. And Dick Moore, the final tick of sturdy clock at 95. Some dumb thing will silence me. A blow to the head, a drunken fender, the creaking of the clock, bird flu. And you? So cobble up a shrine before you die, a dogged hole entangled in the roots of words. Inspire to fill the mind with grace. Expire, breathe out a final song.
Thank you so much for reading that. When we are to cobble together this shrine with meaningful words, I wonder, when did you start to see yourself as a poet?
So in Deep Here, Wisconsin, where I grew up, which is about 4,000 people at the time, this is in the, born in 44, it was not uncommon to have somebody in your little town who could paint portraits of people. And we had one right down the street, this extraordinary woman. So my mother took my older sister down to that portrait painter, and she painted my oldest sister as a princess, and she remained a princess her whole life. She painted my next sister in a very vigorous dance mode. She was a toe dancer at the time. We're talking 6 years old or five. And She, to this day, she's 82, is a incredible physical therapist, hiker, skier, dancer, unbelievable. She's a complete physical being. Then my mother took me down, 3 years old. I can't believe I was three, except I have the portrait in my office and the date doesn't lie. She walked in with me and the painter looked at me and said, put me on a chair and said, that boy needs a book in his hands. I was 3 years old. I've had a love affair with books since I was 3 years old. I have no memory of being three, that except that I have that portrait. Let me fast forward to maybe a decade or so ago, about the time of the beginning of this collection of poems, when I came upon this astounding phrase by perhaps America's greatest, most inspiring writer, Emerson. And the phrase is, language is fossil poetry. And think about that. It's true. Every syllable that I am inserting into your ears through the airwaves of Wisconsin Public Radio and to your listeners, everyone has a history. And some of them were invented yesterday, and some of them were invented 10,000 years ago. And doesn't that just blow your mind? Every word is fossil poetry. And so I've gone on many, many treks down the rabbit hole of the fossil poetry of every word in a fascination that goes back to much of my life. I will say I went to Dartmouth College. They had one class in creative writing, and I took it.
One class.
One class at the time. Now we all have MFA programs everywhere. I went to the graduate school at the University of Wisconsin for a master's. Loved it, by the way. And there was one class in creative writing. I took it. And I remember this because the year is 1967. And the visiting poet sent his students off. He said, go bring back a poet you love. And I ran off to the university's rare book vault. I remember just blasting off to the rare book vault and pulling out copies of Robert Bly's Little Magazine, the 50s and the 60s. There are two things probably that sent me there, and this is at the core of my learning to love poetry. One is he was very active in the anti-war movement and used poetry as part of that and went around the country. He started a group called Poets and Writers Against the War in Vietnam, and it was very public. Not parenthetically, in Minneapolis, I started a group called Poets, Writers, and Musicians Against the War on the Earth, entirely modeled after what Robert did. So the second thing, however, and this is relevant to all your listeners in this part of the world, I sense the fragrance of corn stubble in his poems. A familiar Midwestern landscape. That here was a poet who set up his writing life on a row crop farm in Western Minnesota, corn and beans, and became one of the most consequential poets of the last 60 years. Who knew such a thing could happen? And yet he did that and became my mentor, and oddly, in a astounding circumstance, he moved in next door for the last 15 years of his life.
Oh, wow.
That doesn't happen either, but no. It did happen. And I actually organized his funeral when he passed away. But it's a fascination with the sound of words, the roots of words, the long vowels, which entrance us. Robert Bly has a wonderful essay called The Seven Holy Vowels. And you can hear them in Yeats. We will arise and go now and go to Innisfree. Hear those vowels just roll over the horizon. So those are some of the things. I've always been entranced by the pieces of language and how it goes together. But I opened with that poem because I wanted people to realize what persists through all of this. And the answer is art. And so when I say, you know, my friend Dick Moore's poems are still with us. Hopefully mine will be, but Yeats' poems are with us. And of course, the great, all art, I don't know if you remember the Islamic State blasting and burning the stone remains of Nineveh was an absolute calamity. But then they found this old poem, 3,000 years old, 2,500 years old. And it still sings to us. So art gives us hope because art is persistent.
We are talking with poet James Lenfesti about his new collection. It's called Time Remaining, Body Odes, Praise Songs, Oddities, Amazements. James, the first section of your book is odes about various parts of the body. And the first one is an ode to your ankle, which you wrote after you seriously injured it. Can you tell us about that poem and the ode to the ankle?
So I've always loved the Odes Elementales of Pablo Neruda, mostly as translated by Robert Bly and others. But I love Neruda's flow. They flowed like a waterfall down the page, long and narrow columns, kind of like Angel Falls in Yosemite, you know, bouncing down off rocks. And I love that long, free flowing form. And then, believe it or not, on an island in Michigan, Mackinac Island, where my wife and I live in the summer, I went to a lecture by a Neruda scholar, and he told us the most amazing detail. He said, you know how he invented that form, that long, narrow form for his elemental odes? I said, none of us knew, of course. He said, he had a pal who owned a newspaper in Caracas. And the guy said, I'll publish any of your poems, but they have to fit in a newspaper column. And doesn't that blow your mind? I mean, here's the, you know, the Nobel Prize winning beloved poet. That's how he came up with this form. So I had just heard that lecture, and the following day I skidded out of my socks on a bike rack and tore the daylights out of my ankle. So, and that tore a couple of tendons loose. They were frolicking around on my ankle. And I was lying in bed, wondering where this would go. And I wrote Ode to the Ankle. And the rest is history. It just, the ode gates opened.
The ode gates, the body parts. Yeah.
Ode to the Ankle. Then I looked down at my hand, at my left hand. Oh, what's that story? And then what about this belly of mine or yours? And on and on. And then, of course, the heart.
Yeah. So your ankle really confined you to a bed for that recovery, but poetry really freed you to go anywhere.
Totally. Totally. It was just an amazing moment. So, and the form, you know, poets generally need a container in which to put the poem, just like, the frame for a painter. Mm-hmm. And I had many delightful years working in the Chinese style form of the shir, and which is, again, 8 lines, more or less. And this container sent me in a whole other ecstatic direction. There's much, much joy and astonishment in these poems because of the ability to keep going, to just let the images leap down the page, mm-hmm. one after the other after the other.
James, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your words.
It's a great honor to be with you in my beloved state of Wisconsin and not be hysterical over the election.
I appreciate our conversation very much. Take care.
Same to you. And all best to your listeners.
That was Wisconsin native poet James Lenfesti. Lives in Minneapolis, talked with us about his new collection. It's called Time Remaining, Body Odes, Praise Songs, Oddities, Amazements.
We just heard some poetry on the program today, and we wonder what poem speaks to you. Is there one that you keep up with in your life? Maybe go back to again and again. What is it about the poem's message or theme that sticks with you?
Maybe you get inspiration from a particular poet, or the poet is you. Do you write it? And could you share a sample of your work?
Call or text us to get in touch about poetry in all its forms. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And thank you for sharing your writing and talking about poetry.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.